I just say a couple of things. We'll be looking, beginning to look in the book of Ecclesiastes. So if you have your Bibles, you might want to turn there now. Life is confusing. I think I probably wouldn't get a whole lot of argument from that. You may feel from time to time like life is like a jigsaw puzzle where there's some strategic pieces missing, and it's hard to get a picture of the whole because you don't have those important pieces of the puzzle. And if that's the way you view life from time to time, or maybe a lot of the time, then you're going to really love Ecclesiastes. Sometimes life may seem to you like you're in a boat and the drain plug has been pulled out. And you're spending a lot of your time bailing water and getting nowhere fast. If that's sign of kind of where you're at and the way you view life sometimes, Ecclesiastes is for you. I personally hate to waste time. If I wash my car on Monday and it rains on Tuesday, oh man, you know, even just a drizzle, it gets the roads all muddy and then it looks as if you haven't washed your car, that's time wasted. That's why I never wash my car, because you never know, it might just rain. Or if you spend hours someday watering your yard and then that freak thunderstorm happens, oh, why wasted all that water? And the fear may be that not only do we waste time and water, but you look at life and you wonder, is life a waste? Then Ecclesiastes is for you. Now, if you hope to find help from Ecclesiastes, you should be forewarned about a couple of things. It is a different kind of book than any other of the 65 books that make up our Bible. Very different kind of life perspective you find in this most provocative book. And because of its peculiarities, both Christians and Jews have gone to some extraordinary lengths to understand and explain it. Some ancient Jewish commentators have referred to Ecclesiastes as the black sheep of the Bible. And there are some who are on record as saying you shouldn't even read it. And whoever reads the book of Ecclesiastes and studies it defiles their hands. And I understand. We're going to come across some very strange-sounding advice as we work our way through the book of Ecclesiastes. The author will say things like, money is the answer to everything. And he will also say, don't be excessively righteous. And don't be so consumed with wisdom. Now, well-meaning interpreters have read that and they've thought, well, that's weird, so let's do something with that. And they've put question marks at the end of those sentences. They're not in the original, but it softens the blow a little bit. Money isn't really the answer to everything, is it? Now, I understand the sentiment that would cause us to put a question mark there, but it's not there. So it's not justified to put that question mark there. And a lot of people, in coming to Ecclesiastes, paraphrase, allegorize, and explain away. And what we're going to do as we come to the book of Ecclesiastes is we're going to take it at face value, we're going to wrestle with its complexities, and we're going to see if we can't find what the author of Ecclesiastes is getting across. Are these just the meanderings of a bitter old man, or is there something helpful here? Something even hopeful here? When you think of Ecclesiastes, which may not be several times every day, but maybe it will be on your mind more as we go through this, the word that may come to your mind is the word vanity. You're so vain. We're going to do that every time the word vanity comes up in our study of... No. Thought that was cute. Thank you, Charlie. The Hebrew word for vanity is... It occurs 20 times in the book of Ecclesiastes. That's more than in any other book of the Bible. So it would be spot on to say that the theme of Ecclesiastes is the vanity of life. We're introduced to the concept of vanity right off the bat as Solomon starts talking about vanity in the very first verse. It means empty, pointless. Think soap bubbles. My handy-dandy illustration machine. I never was very good at that. Now I've dropped it. Oh, no. Whenever you see the word vanity in the Bible, or especially in Ecclesiastes, think something where there's no substance. There's really nothing to it. It's short-lived. It's pointless. About the closest thing to zero you can imagine. For instance, 2 Kings chapter 17, the author of 2 Kings spends some time scolding the Jews for practicing idolatry, and he says that the Jews followed vanity. That's the word he uses for false gods, vanities. And then he says that you, the people of God, became vain. The Bible teaches that whatever we choose to worship, we take on the character of that thing, and if we choose to worship vanity, we become vain. Choose to worship zero, we become zero. Ecclesiastes will say a lot about vanity and will say that there are a lot of things that are vain, empty, futile, worthless, like trying to find fulfillment in work. Major theme of the book of Ecclesiastes is you can't find ultimate fulfillment in work. It says that it is vain to try to figure out life. What's the big meaning of it? Because there are too many exceptions to the rules. The fact that our lives are short makes life vanity. It's vain that you can't even find ultimate fulfillment in pleasure. Ecclesiastes takes us on a ride to brutal honesty. And the distinctiveness of the book of Ecclesiastes is that the author of the book is willing to take logical arguments to their logical extreme. And many of us are often not willing to do that. And vanity is Ecclesiastes' way of saying that life is disappointing, unfulfilling, directionless, purposeless, and meaningless. This is not going to go down as Dave's happy sermon, okay? The clearest statement we have to that effect is at the very beginning of the book, the words of the preacher, the son of David, king of Jerusalem, vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Not a terribly upbeat way to start a book. There's been debate through the years about who wrote Ecclesiastes. There's no debate in my mind. He identifies himself here as the son of David, king in Jerusalem. It's Solomon. The Jews have believed that Solomon wrote Ecclesiastes for centuries. And then you look at what the book addresses, and it's a Solomon-like life history. And the life that Solomon lived is just fascinating. He was named Solomon, which means peaceful one. God gave him the name Jedidiah, beloved of the Lord. It's not a silver spoon in Solomon's mouth at birth. It's a 24-karat gold spoon. He was born to wealth, privilege, royalty. He had everything in the world going for him. Solomon expanded the kingdom during his reign. He built the palace. He built the temple. He was known for wisdom and justice and brilliance and wealth. And then somewhere along the line, he got off track. Turned from the wisdom that had guided him for the first part of his life. And he became an absolute materialist. He worshipped other gods. He became a committed sensualist. And he walked away from God. Now, when we study the book of Ecclesiastes, we've got to remember the life story of this man, because he tasted it all, from the heights to the depths. He knew the joys of a walk with God, and then he knew rebellion, high-handed rebellion and apostasy. And he brings all of that to the book of Ecclesiastes. Now, he didn't die in apostasy. The reason we know that is because of the Solomon trilogy we have in the Old Testament. He wrote Proverbs, he wrote the Song of Solomon, and he wrote Ecclesiastes. And for the next few minutes, we're going to give ourselves to the prologue of the book, the first 11 verses of Ecclesiastes chapter 1. And we're going to see what is not only the theme of the prologue, but it's also a preview of what's to come, the rest of the book. The overall message is the vanity of life under the sun. So just keep that in mind. It's the vanity of life under the sun. And he doesn't just make the statement, all is vanity. He goes on to argue his case. And as the first witness for the defense, proving that life is vain, he calls to the stand the natural world. Verses 3 and 4. What advantage does man have in all his work which he does under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. Just think of all the great dynasties that have paraded across the stage of human history. Ming Dynasty of China, the Khans of Asia, the Arabian princes, Hittites, Babylonians, Assyrians, Greeks, Romans, more recently the Khmer Rouge of Cambodia, Hitler's Third Reich, the USSR, USA, Mexico, Canada, and lots of great kingdoms that have come and gone. And watching over all of them is an indifferent, passive earth. My family and I, we went on a hike through a part of Rocky Mountain National Park some years ago, and there was a sign at the trailhead that said, "The mountains don't care." That's a great sign, because if you're tired, hungry, disoriented, get lost, the blizzard comes, the mountains don't care. They're just there. They're just passionate. All of human history put together, Everest doesn't care, McKinley doesn't care, the Sahara doesn't care, the Amazon doesn't care, the Pacific doesn't care. Solomon wants you and me to be thinking about the trivial impact of humanity on Earth. He mentions three natural phenomena that highlight just how irrelevant we are to the way the world works. And the first thing he mentions is the sun. The sun rises and the sun sets, and hastening to its place, it rises there again. Now, in college, one of my minors was philosophy, a very valuable major. That plus 25 cents in those days, and I could have bought a great cup of coffee. But I read a lot of philosophy. I read Hemingway. He wrote a book called The Sun Also Rises. For years, I thought Hemingway made up that phrase all by himself. He stole a line from Ecclesiastes 1:5. And Hemingway set out to write a book that life is pointless, and he stole from Solomon, whose book is to say the exact same thing. Every day the sun rises and the sun sets. Of course, the Bible's talking just the way the weathermen do. Just as we observe it, it appears the sun rises and the sun sets. I'm not talking scientifically here. Nothing alters this unalterable fact of nature. We get our daily rhythms from the sunrise and the sunset. It never changes. If you've got a day tomorrow that you are dreading because of the challenges your Monday faces, the sun's going to rise. If on the very best day of your life you just don't want the day to end, the sun's going to set. You have zero control over it. Then Solomon mentions the wind. Blowing toward the south, then turning toward the north, the wind continues swirling along, and on its circular courses, the wind returns. There's always the wind. Recently, Kathy and I were driving back from Colorado to San Antonio, and so one of the facts of life is whenever you're driving back from Colorado to San Antonio, you have to drive through Texas. So we decided we would take the scenic route through Texas. There is no more or less scenic route through Texas. They're all equally scenic. Anyway, the route we decided to take was through a near Sweetwater. Whoa. Near Sweetwater, up on high plateaus stretching for miles, are hundreds, maybe thousands of windmills. If you've been by there, it's just an amazing spectacle. These huge windmills just turning with the wind. And they are a testimony to the marvels of engineering. They're also a testimony to something else. Not only do the propellers rotate, but the windmills are built on a pivot so that they can turn to catch the wind whichever way the wind happens to be blowing. And what that says is, we don't know which way the wind's going to be blowing. We are ignorant of the wind. Whichever way it's going to blow, that's the way it's going to blow, north, south, east, or west. We can't control it. The wind is an enigma. It's always there. It's an important part of the way the world works, and we don't have a clue as to which way the wind's going to blow. And then Solomon mentions water. The hydrologic cycle, which ancient man understood every bit as well as we do, and he describes it in verse 7. All the rivers flow into the sea, yet the sea is not full. To the place where the rivers flow, there they flow again. I was in Minnesota this past week, Tuesday through Thursday, and from the plain, you could see the mighty Mississippi. Well, Solomon wants you and me to consider right now one little water droplet in the mighty Mississippi. This water droplet fell probably as snow. It snowed there this week. And then it made its way down into a creek and a stream and then into the river. And it's going to join billions and billions of other little water droplets that will flow south from Mississippi through Minnesota, through Missouri and Illinois on that border and all the other borders all the way to New Orleans to the Gulf of Mexico. And then once it's in the Gulf of Mexico, it will evaporate. Be drawn up into a cloud where it will condense, and there in the cloud will drift northward and will hover somewhere over the Mississippi River Basin, will fall as rain or snow into a creek or a river, then into the Mississippi and down to the Gulf of Mexico, only to start the whole process all over again. A pointless, progressless cycle that never, ever ends. Now, why does Solomon tell us about these forces of nature? He mentions the sun and the wind to show that the forces of nature are outside of our control, so we are weak and impotent. Shows us that they go on regardless of whether we're present or not. We are irrelevant. And he mentions water and the water cycle to say, just as water's cycle is meaningless, so is my life. Solomon looks out from his palace and sees the beauty of nature and realizes it's not going anywhere. My life's not going anywhere. And he would look at me and say, Dave, your life isn't going anywhere. This life under the sun is meaningless. And he'd say the same thing to you. Your life isn't going anywhere. Just think about the sun, the wind, the water. And then Solomon brings another witness to the stand to testify to the vanity of life, and that's human history. Verse 8. All things are wearisome. Man is not able to tell it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor is the ear filled with hearing. That which has been is that which will be, and that which has been done is that which will be done. So there's nothing new under the sun. We've heard that phrase before. Is there anything of which one might say, see this, it's new? Already it's existed for ages which were before us. Now, I don't think that Solomon is meaning to talk here about invention and technology. There were probably new ways of doing things, construction and farming in his day, as there is in our own day, so they didn't have Wi-Fi and Bluetooth, but they did have some other new ways of doing things. More to the point, I think what Solomon is saying is, despite the fact that some things change, the remarkable fact is that the more things change, the more they remain the same. Solomon wrote about 800 B.C., and we're in the 21st century, 2008. Here is something that's true about 2008. When one nation offends another nation, that first nation will retaliate. That is unique to world history. In 2008, in marriages, husbands and wives sometimes have a hard time getting along with each other. Shocking. It's never happened before. Now. In 2008, children and teenagers sometimes rebel and want to express themselves in new and different ways. Can you imagine that? Biblical morality is not upheld. Injustice abounds. Shocking, brand new stuff. No, it's not. That kind of stuff has been around forever, from the days of Solomon to today. Solomon's point is that, yeah, our surroundings may change and the technology may change, but we don't change. Fundamentally, life doesn't change. And then he wraps up this prologue, verse 11, by smashing one of the fondest held dreams most of us have, and that's to be remembered fondly. There is no remembrance of earlier things, and also of the later things which will occur. There will be for them no remembrance among those who will come later still. Now, I loved my parents dearly. Both my parents are gone now. My mother died in 1980. It's 28 years ago. She was a wonderful woman. We had a fine relationship. But it's been 3 decades since Mom died of colon cancer. And I'll tell you that except in those occasions when there is an event I just wish she was there for, I don't think about my mom all the time. My father died in 2002. Much more recently, I think about him much more frequently. But if you ask my children, how often do you think of your father's father? And they knew him, and he was a good man. I doubt if they would think about him all that often. I had great relationships with my paternal grandparents. My father's parents and I just got along great. I was the only boy of 8 cousins. They loved me. But months will pass without my thinking about my grandparents. Now, I hope you don't think that I'm just an insensitive clod for not thinking about my dead, more recent ancestors. But I don't think I'm unique. I don't think we spend a lot of time thinking about loved ones who have died long, long time ago. No guilt trip intended here. But Solomon doesn't want you and me to be in denial about what's going to happen after we're gone, too. Life goes on. People get on with their lives. Posterity is a really nice thought. A legacy that lasts for hundreds of years is probably not a peg you want to hang all your hopes on. Now, if it seems like I'm just standing up here having a slightly overdue midlife crisis, well, maybe I am, but I'm not trying to be negative. Just trying to grapple with what Solomon says in Ecclesiastes 1:1-11. A lot of people read this passage or read this book and say, Ecclesiastes is depressing, it's morbid, it's existential, and I say it's honest. Look at life under the sun, and he deals with life and death and justice and injustice and wisdom and foolishness and God. And he does. We're about to wrap up our time, and I want to finish with a story. And it'll help explain the title of the message this morning. All of us like a good story, and this story comes not from the Bible, it comes from Greek mythology. And the story was actually popularized back in the 1940s when a French philosopher named Albert Camus wrote a book with the title featuring the main character in the myth. The myth of Sisyphus. Sisyphus was supposedly an historical figure who was the king and founder of the ancient city of Corinth. We don't know much. It's all shrouded in lots of history. Homer was the first one to tell the story. According to some versions of the story, Sisyphus was a really good man. According to others, he was a scoundrel and even a murderer. But the story of Sisyphus turns to pure myth when we read in this story, when we're told that the god of the underworld, Hades, or Pluto, wanted Sisyphus for life in the underworld, death in the underworld, and he was going to take him there. By some means, and the stories conflict here, Sisyphus escaped the clutches of Hades and actually locked up Hades for a while on Earth. Now, that threw things seriously out of whack, because with Hades locked up, nobody on Earth could die. So it was a very nice season for planet Earth. But eventually, Hades was able to free himself by eliciting the help of the god of war, Mars. And so he was free, and man, was he mad at Sisyphus. Well, Sisyphus still was able to elude Hades' grasp for some time. He lived to a ripe old age, and the inevitable came, and he died. And he came face to face with the god he had tricked. And this myth goes on to say that Hades had prepared an especially appropriate, in his mind, eternal assignment for Sisyphus. Sisyphus' assignment was to stand at the base of a mountain where there was a large boulder and push the boulder all the way up to the top of the mountain, where the mountain crested, and then the boulder rolled over to the other side of the mountain. His task then was to walk down the mountain to the boulder, push it up, upon which the boulder would roll down to the bottom. You get the idea. Over and over and over and over and over and over and over all through eternity, that was Sisyphus' fate. And my impression from reading Ecclesiastes 1, 1-11, is that Solomon would hear the myth of Sisyphus and say, that's what I'm talking about. In fact, Sisyphus was an optimist. Based on what we hear Solomon saying throughout the book of Ecclesiastes, Sisyphus will look like he's got it easy. Solomon's going to have a whole lot to say about life and meaning and purpose in Ecclesiastes, and even how to get there, but he started us off honestly as he possibly can. Life under the sun is meaningless. It's empty. All is vanity. Now I've asked my good friend, Hadley Reed, to come up and share a bit of his testimony. And if that's not a lead-in, Hadley, let's pray for Hadley.
Thanks, brother.